In many different areas of life, one of the most frustrating and annoying things is when people present what we call in logic and philosophy a false dilemma. It's either this or this. And our thinking is, there are many other options. So when you're forced in politics to vote between Jack Johnson and John Jackson, you can't quite figure out which guy you're going to vote for. And then they tell you, well, you should vote. That's what a citizen should do. And you're just like, well, whatever. You get really kind of frustrated. And getting caught in between, there's no way to act. You get almost just bitter about the whole thing. And it's not just in politics that this happens. This happens in our own life of prayer and our spiritual lives when we start thinking as, well, we start. We've always been thinking as human beings do and not as God does. And then we don't go through the conversion of thinking as God thinks and not as human beings do. And we have almost wedged ourselves into a dichotomy that is expressed very beautifully by the wisdom of The Simpsons. Most notably, I'm talking about the cartoon here. You're thinking it's like, oh, is that some philosopher that I've never heard about? Yes, yes, but it's not the wise Homer, it's the other one. So you have this moment in The Simpsons where the end of the world is about to happen. And you're given a glimpse of the city, and on the left side of the screen you see the church in Springfield, and on the left you see the church in Springfield. I had to totally reverse my perspective here. That's very symbolic, by the way. On the left you see the church in Springfield, and then on the right you see Moe's Tavern, the local bar. And when the world is about to be falling apart and then the skies are peeling open and then all the people who are in the church go to the bar and then all the people who are in the bar go to the church. And I looked at that and I said, yeah, that's pretty much true. Because it symbolizes or represents an inner envy on the part of the world. Many people who try to trod the path of righteousness secretly resent those people who can just go, yeah. And this is alcohol, by the way. The dissolute living, they envy sometimes the freedom of those who are unfettered. The people that can, you know, it's like Sunday morning, that's where I'm going to go golfing. Yeah. And it's like, oh, I've got to wake up and go to church, da 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 da. So one of the ways in which we emotionally compensate is we start pretending as if we're better people. It's like, well, I'm not like those people who waste their Sunday mornings on something pointless and stupid. I go to church. And in the end, you don't hear the joy of the gospel. You hear the bitter joy of a person who just wants to be sanctimonious and is really frustrated that nobody sees how much better they are than other people. So when the end of the world happens, they want to just go out in a blaze of glory. Because if God has been lying to them their entire life, then darn it, I'm just going to enjoy myself before this whole thing ends. And in fact, when many people may live a life of faithfulness for decade after decade after decade, and then in old age, boom, we have to begin to ask ourselves, and John in his first letter begins to say, what did that person believe to begin with? And then there's the other side, the bar side. And it seems on the outside that they have found emancipation, but really, not necessarily. We've all heard the, I'm never doing this again. We've all heard the, ugh. We've all heard the betrayal. We've all heard the sadness. We've all heard the emptiness and the superficiality of it. All you have to do is to have a science experiment at 11 o'clock at night on a Saturday evening, sit on Douglas Street and say, yeah, this really isn't all that appealing. But in our culture, those are the only options that we appear to be given. And that is a false dilemma. And even among these two sons in today's gospel, those seem to be the only options. So the firstborn son is able to maintain all the trappings of being the best boy, right? Like, in all those cultures where the firstborn son is more important, and then you kind of say, is it because he's smarter? Not necessarily. As the second son, I'm more than happy to advocate that position, even though my brother is smarter than me. He just came out first. That's it. And yet somehow he's the best, brightest, and most capable? Nah. But he's more than happy to maintain the illusion because that makes him special, doesn't it? He's the special one. He's the smart one. And of course, Dad loves me more than you. From the very beginning, Dad has loved me more than you. Actually, I've only existed like a few years after. No. From the very beginning, I'm better and smarter than you. Don't ask Dad. He told me to tell you. And there's your problem. The two sons are living in a world separate from their father. Because if you really pay attention to the overall story, if they would have gone to their dad and say, Dad, which one of us do you love more? It's obvious the answer will be, I love you both. And that you're not in competition. Which is usually why kids will have a habit of separating their conversations from their parents, because the last thing they want to hear is that they're all loved equally. Because if I'm loved equally, then what's the point of being special if everyone's special? So we construct imaginary reasons for us being more important, and then those reasons for making us feel more important, we use to push other people down. So you can imagine the second son, sick and tired of this. And his older brother, insecure in himself, keep pushing it. And then the younger son starts to even associate, even though his dad never says it, I don't even like my dad either. He represents my sadness. He represents my shame. You know what? I want out. And you see a certain amount of the hypocrisy in it. He's like, I don't want anything to do with you, but give me your money. Anybody, any family who's had to deal with this in this inheritance question knows exactly the inherent contradiction in inheritances. That the family shows its inner contradiction. The son shows, I only love Dad insofar as he's got me a lot of money. Runs off and squanders the whole thing. He's given a chance to live all those dreams of freedom that he hasn't been able to live at home. He went to college to find himself. He read Eat, Pray, Love, and then he now feels emancipated. Well, we all know how far that emancipation goes. And of course, he winds up being lower than the pigs. This is still a Jewish audience that's hearing this. The most unclean of animals, lower still. But there's a line of tremendous import in the gospel which we need to constantly remember. He comes to himself. He remembers who he is. I'm a son of such a father. Now, sometimes this is a harder thing to realize than we think, because when we remember our dignity, we remember there's a slight discrepancy between my inherent dignity and how I'm living it. Why am I hanging out with the pigs? Well, I can blame them. I can blame my brother. I can blame my brother as much as I can, but in the end, this was my choice. And I accept the consequences of it. And that's what being a man is. Oh. And so Jesus even gives us the rehearsal in the mirror moment. You know when you have to man up, or woman up, I don't know what the expression is. But you have to man up and say the thing you're terrified to say, and you say it in front of the mirror. Jesus even has, in the parable, him speaking in the mirror. Not as good a mirror as you and I have, but a mirror nonetheless. All right, so I'm going to say, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm going to practice this. I'm going to rehearse this. It's like, yeah, but when you go back, your brother's going to be totally smug about it. I know. I'm going to go back and be a servant, and then all of a sudden I'm going to give my brother his food, and he's going to say, there's a hair in it, and then have me send it back and cook it. I know the humiliation of it, and I probably want to harm him, but I still got to go home. That Thanksgiving dinner you just really don't want to go back to.
It's just forever.
So he makes the journey. But then you see the heart of the Father. The Father doesn't go,
"You've come back." No. That's the applicant's door. The supplicant's door is down there. You must crawl.
It's very different. He runs to greet him. An old patriarch of a very noble, wealthy family runs to meet his good-for-nothing son. It shows you that real love, real mercy, throws dignity out the window. That this father, although of tremendous dignity, knows what real value is. It is the irreplaceable son, that one for whom he has waited, because his waiting is a part of the healing process. You can't coerce reconciliation. I can't say to my dear friend over here, "You must forgive me and you must come back home." That'll be a really awkward dinner. The father waits, and then when he sees his son, he runs. And not only that, he gives him the rings, he gives him the robe, he gives him the fatted calf, he gives him the sandals, and he puts on a party. You can only imagine the grand discrepancy between the son's image of his father and who the real father is. And only in a moment like this, when all of that fighting with his brother disappears, is he given an opportunity of showing or seeing who the father is. And this is the moment where the father is able to say, "You mean more to me than anything else on this earth." And on that level, reconciliation is pretty easy. It's easy to welcome a person back to church who hasn't been there for 30 years. Speaking as a person whose job it is to do that, it's really easy. They come in, you give them absolution, penances, boom. It's easy. All they have to do is to want it. But the really hard one is the one who for 30 years has developed a nice little crust of self-satisfaction, of their own pride and their own dignity. It's almost impossible to crack that shell. And so the father then embarks to bring back the other son. And then you get the hatred. Listen. That judging, that condemning tone that he unleashed on his younger brother, he unleashes on his father. But sadly, he knows he's unleashing it on himself. For with what judgment we judge other people, we will be judged. Every time we develop the habit of criticizing people's clothes, criticizing people's attitudes, criticizing people's cultures, ways of life, things they can't change or be in their life, the more we develop that habit of criticizing them, I guarantee you that in those quiet moments of solitude in your own life, where it's really hard for us to appreciate our own value, it's all coming back home. And the son reveals, the older son, reveals his self-hatred through his hatred of his father, whom he doesn't really hate, but he doesn't understand how the father loves him. Listen, for all these years I have worked like a slave for you. And therein lies the grand difficulty of the convert, of the person who comes all the time. Do we see the service of God as our life and as our joy, or as the fulfillment of a bunch of rules that God arbitrarily threw on us? Slave labor. That forgiving is some kind of nasty commandment he has us fulfill. That caring for the poor, that caring for each other, that being present, the personal prayer, all these things are drudgeries that God throws on us, or they are things that are a part of his nature. His younger son thought they were a drudgery and gave up. The older son believes the exact same thing. He's just hidden it for a longer period of time. And it's revealed in his lack of mercy because both sons envy each other. Both sons envy each other. The younger son envies the prestige of the older son. The older son envies the so-called freedom of the younger one. So the younger one obviously is willing to just throw it all away. But the older one has an interesting problem because it's not just the morally self-righteous that are the older son. How many of us, when we knew we needed to be healed with God, did not want to grace the doors of a church because we thought Jesus eats with sinners? All the different scandals and difficulties that the church has faced, and they're brutal, and you probably don't even know them all. They are a reality that often prevents us from coming into deeper contact with Him because the judgment we lay upon other Christians for the horrible things that they have done make it impossible for us to seek reconciliation for the bad things that we have done. The brother and the brother are the same man, divided against himself. And it's the Father's hope to make them whole. But both sides need to become humble. Both sides need to forget themselves and become like the Father. To be able to be willing to run and forgive and to be able to humble himself when he need not humble himself. Who, like Jesus Christ, who in the form of God did not deem equality with God as something to be exploited for his own benefit, but rather emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being found in human likeness, he humbled himself so as to make himself sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God, that all of our failings, all of our mistakes might be able to become transformed into a brand new life, and that envy that makes us run from the church to the bar and from the bar to the church becomes healed. That we are whole again. Because it is a false dilemma. The Simpsons, although wise, is not a great place to get the full program of human existence. It's much better to look at the saints. And I'll give you an interesting example from a saint you may or may not have heard of. His name is St. Francis of Assisi, 13th century saint. And one of his more high-strung brothers comes out and runs to him and says, Francis, Brother Francis, he's not St. Francis yet, but they pretty much thought so anyway. Brother Francis, Brother Francis, Brother Francis, what would you do? Like, this is a comic book guy's hypothetical question extraordinaire. What would you do if you knew the world was about to end? Would you stock up and arm up for the zombie apocalypse? How would you get yourself prepared? How would you prepare for the end of the world? Would you reconcile? Would you do this? Would you fall on your knees in prayer? Would you say this prayer? Do this, do that, do this? Francis just goes, Given the options, I think I would continue hoeing the gardens.